The Harlot in Revelation 17 and 19 by B. Holweda. Translator's Preface. This is a translation of the Dutch publication De Hoer in Openbaring 17 and 19, written by Professor B. Holweda in the early 1950s. As the introduction will inform the reader, it was written in defense of Professor Holweda's exegesis of Revelation 17 through 19, with regards to the harlot. This exegesis was originally put forth in 1949 in two speeches at a youth rally. Together they are available in English as translated by Dr. P. Y. de Jong under the title The Church in the Last Judgment. They also should be available soon from Inheritance Publications in combination with the present defense in one booklet as Bride or Harlot. Wherever possible, a literal translation has been employed to maintain Professor Holweda's true intended meaning. It is the hope of those involved in the translation that this publication will assist in the edification of the Church of Christ, and thereby promote his honor and glory through studying the recurring themes in the history of salvation. Mrs. R. Hoeksma and other ladies. Introduction. This publication is more or less a continuation of and an addition to the first one which I wrote for this series, entitled The Church in the Last Judgment. However, this one is somewhat different in format. One who is familiar with the first one will understand why this is so, for the first one consisted of two speeches which I gave at a youth rally in 1949 in Wassenaar. Naturally, because of this, it was theatrical in character. The second publication, however, came to be mostly due to the criticisms the first one received. Since I am of the opinion that this criticism is to be rejected and deserves a refutation, I was compelled to write this one in a polemical format. However, this does not mean that in the pages which follow I will answer all the criticism which drew my attention. For instance, I refuse to carry on the controversy regarding criticism from synodical quarters. Footnote: by synodical, the author means the people who followed the Synod of the Reformed Churches in the Netherlands in 1944. Professor Dr. Herman Ridderbos wrote an article in Gereformeerd Weekblad under the heading Liberation and Apocalyptics, in which he, in a very authoritative tone, asserted a great deal without proving anything. The harlot of Revelation 17 is not the church, but the world, according to Ridderbos. And what is more, he would not be able to name a reputable exegete today which would support such an interpretation, or even take the possibility into consideration. Of course, this does not mean that these exegetes do not exist, but only that Ridderbos does not know of them. Apparently, he does not even seem to know that his own father-in-law, Mr. J. H. Cock, published, in 1926, for the third time even, a book about Revelation with the beautiful title The Hemel Geopend, The Heavens Revealed. It was a new publication of a national edition. The writer of the book was Dr. J. C. de Moor, who acquired his degree at the same university as Ridderbos. De Moor knows a thing or two about exegesis, whose outstanding services in our churches is most certainly well known. De Moor also recognized the harlot of Revelation 17 as the false church, and, as had been stated previously, Mr. Cock has brought this exegesis to the attention of the people, three times over. More serious than this lack of information is the fact that Professor Ridderbos does not come up with any essential argumentation against my lectured exegesis. His whole article is nothing more than a fierce and bitter outburst in which he does not even attempt to be polite. In this situation, a discussion with people such as Ridderbos has no merit. Also, from some of our own brothers, I received opposition regarding this matter. And by one of them, Reverend Ploy, I was openly attacked and challenged. I promised several of them, long before the article by Professor Ridderbos was published, that I would return to this exegetical problem as soon as time permitted. To answer questions from brothers is always possible, is it not? And it is also right to reply to criticisms of brothers, even more so since Reverend Ploy tried to deliver an essential refutation. All questions which were put to me will gradually be dealt with in my answer to Reverend Ploy. It is impossible for me to repeat all of his articles here, but I believe that the readers will receive sufficient orientation and that I will do justice to Reverend Ploy by giving the following summary which he himself gave when he concluded his series of articles. We now have to come to the conclusion of our criticism of Professor Holweda's exegesis of Revelation 17, at the same time answering our own questions which came up in these articles. We have found that Professor Holweda's argument is based on three pillars. A. The astonishment of the Apostle John regarding the harlot, whom he recognizes as the woman of Revelation 12, the Church. B. His understanding of Babylon the Great in a spiritual sense as being Jerusalem. And C. His reference to Ezekiel 16 and 23, where the harlot is named Jerusalem. After investigating these three pillars, our conclusion must be A. That Professor Holweda's explanation of John's astonishment has the context in which the text was written against him. B. That Professor Holweda's explanation of Babylon the Great as being Jerusalem is not based on solid exegetical grounds, and that wherever mention is made in the last book of the Bible of the great city, it refers to the city of Rome in those days, exemplifying the big secular city of the end of time. And C. That Professor Holweda, by his reference to Ezekiel 16 and 23, does no justice to the striking and multiple quotations in Revelation 18, taken from Isaiah 13, 21, 23, 47, and 48, Jeremiah 50 and 51, and Ezekiel 26 and 27, in which chapters no mention is made of a church city, Jerusalem, but rather a secular city, Babel, Tyre, or Nineveh, as in Nahum 3. With this, we believe that we have attacked the issue in an essential manner with good argumentation against an exegesis which has become quite popular among us today, an exegesis which is propagated in all possible forms, yes, which is poured out upon our youth especially. However, proper argumentation is given nowhere. Section 2. The Authority of Common Opinions. Permit me to begin with Reverend Ploy's complaint, namely that I have not given reasonable argumentation for my exegesis. According to Reverend Ploy, this is in agreement with the manner in which this exegesis was forced down the throats of our youth. This is regrettable. He continues to say that he hopes his criticism may contribute to break the spell of Professor Holweda's exegesis, bring further reflection upon the matter, that thereby public account may be rendered. I presume that I must understand it in this way. According to Reverend Ploy, I committed a resentful rashness against our youth by pouring a new exegesis into them and leaving the one of Professor Gridanus, the common one. I then had to first give public account of the grounds on which I had left the exegesis of Professor Gridanus, before I had the moral right to speak to the youth in such a popular fashion. To come straight to the point, I do not believe a word of this. Anyone who speaks to the congregation from the pulpit or to the youth from a different platform must know what he is discussing and should have truly examined the issue. Permit me to say, for example, in the course of his study, a person comes upon a text with three or more different explanations, and he himself has to weigh the arguments over against one another, coming to a well-considered choice of his own. But he does not have the moral obligation to first publicly justify his not-so-popular choice of exegesis before he is allowed to present it. Otherwise, no minister would be allowed on the pulpit anymore. For after all, there are very few texts in which differences in exegetical opinions do not exist. If a minister, before he would be allowed to preach, first had to defend his explanation in a more or less knowledgeable way, then we might as well all pack up and leave. It would boil down to this. We would have censorship on exegesis. In this manner, only one particular explanation would be proclaimed as the common one, to which everyone would be bound, while someone who had a different understanding would first have to give account for his scholarly argumentation before he would be allowed to speak to the congregation or its youth. Fortunately, we do not have this situation yet. I believe that the binding of Scripture and confession is sufficient, and everyone who in his preaching and oration adheres to these has the right to present his explanation, which he, on a solid basis, contends to be the correct interpretation. Just like myself, Reverend Ploy must have heard or read sermons in which he came to the conclusion, the preacher followed the exegesis of A, but I feel more for the opinion of B. Do we then have to express our sadness because the minister left the exegesis of B? I think not. Moreover, how often does Reverend Ploy want to put this public accountability into practice? I mean, who has to form this committee to judge? Of course, not the congregation. They receive the popular education. Obviously, these have to be a number of people who are capable to analyze the not-so-popular. A number of theologians, perhaps? After all, it is a matter of spiritual exegesis. Who has to appoint these? And how will they be able to agree among themselves? Do they have the infallible exegesis? If such a committee came into existence, is Reverend Ploy himself prepared to request preaching consent if he is holding an exegesis which deviates from the norm? Reverend Ploy is using the easy term common exegesis. I had my fill of this term when ecclesiastical assemblies were commissioned against people who in preaching and writing did not agree with opinions which were announced as being common. I believe that the pitiful fencing of the term common was demonstrated clearly in those days. At what time must or may we call an opinion common? Already at first glance, pro and con opinions become readily evident, even when dealing with one point. Who is then to decide which is the common view? Can anyone, no matter who, even trace how many supporters an opinion has? Does one have the necessary data at his disposal? And suppose that he was actually able to decide opinion A was shared by 10, B by 8, C by 11, and D by 3. Which interpretation is to be dubbed common? Is then the decision in the masses? Does it then become a matter of relative or absolute majority? Remaining within the confines of Revelation 17, Reverend Ploy must himself immediately agree that there are, at minimum, three different exegeses, each with numerous variations. I have read extensively about this chapter, and I doubt if there are even two persons who think the same. For instance, there is the opinion of the commentators who wrote the annotations to the Dordt Study Bible, mostly followed by the Moore. Then there is the different explanation of Professor Greidanus, and Rignalda's is different also. With these examples, I remain within the Reformed community of the Netherlands. If we go outside of this circle and read the explanations of Sclater, Sahn, Charles, Bousset, Kiddel, and others, who then is yet to say whose is the popular opinion? Reverend Ploy is quite intelligent if he, regarding Revelation 17, can trace how many adhere to the annotations of the Dordt Study Bible, how many were influenced by the commentaries of Professor Greidanus or by the book by Reverend Rignalda. Common opinions are fictitious. Section 3. The Great Difficulty of the Common Explanation. Reverend Ploy complains that I fail to give reasonable argumentation for my thesis. This complaint astonished me, regardless of what I wrote before. I in no wise expected such a remark, especially after a Reverend Ploy's own articles. His criticism was aimed at three pillars, on which my opinion seemed to be resting. Regarding pillars, I certainly must be allowed to assume he meant the points of complete support on which my whole argument was resting, the fundamental ideas which uphold everything, just as pillars under a bridge. When, in this context, Reverend Ploy employs the verb seem, then I may take it for granted that he discovered, according to his own conviction, these three points of support on which the whole case is resting. This is why I do not understand his complaint regarding the lack of argumentation, nor his request for public account. For an argument is, after all, proof of a thesis. As a matter of fact, the same thing as a pillar of a thesis. In what way can Reverend Ploy, on the one hand, point to the pillars and, on the other hand, say that these are not there? This is unfortunate for Reverend Ploy, for he could have saved himself the trouble. He fought against pillars, but they were no pillars at all. What he refers to under A, B, and C are sections of my speech which are not arguments of support. These three points belong to the superstructure, not to the foundation under it, which, at times, can be referred to as pillars. Reverend Ploy should not take offense, but I have the impression that he was somewhat hasty in the writing of his articles. What I mean to say is, he did not pay enough attention to the great deal of points which are at stake here. He also does not seem aware of the questionability of the exegesis he is advocating. Perhaps he will reply, "This remark applies to Gridanus also," but only partly so, I believe. Anyone who has studied the Book of Revelation knows of the many problems this book puts before the reader, especially in terms of exegesis. Professor Gridanus amended several points of his argument in the course of the years. A simple comparison between his first and last study of Revelation will make this evident. Gridanus did not totally comprehend this book, but this is nothing to be ashamed of, for no one will ever be finished with it. At least Gridanus brought us a great deal closer. Although I could not accept his solution, Gridanus still shows that he at least clearly recognized the problems. I believe that Reverend Ploy reads and follows Gridanus, but he does not consider the problems sufficiently. One point in particular struck me. Reverend Ploy says in one of his articles, "The explanation of Gridanus, at first reading, gives the impression of contemplating two ideas. For example, Rome as willpower and Rome as papal power. On closer examination, this impression is replaced by another, namely that, also when Gridanus speaks of papal power, he puts the emphasis more on the thought of power than on the idea of false church." Reverend Ploy is of the opinion that a certain contradiction in the exegesis of Gridanus is only a deception, and that he in fact sees the harlot and the beast everywhere as being identical. I cannot agree with this, for Gridanus wrote in connection with this woman, "She is sitting on the beast, and, nevertheless, is distinguished from its heads, the papal power and the Roman church. No more than this beast does this woman represent more than one power at a time. This beast is sometimes the entire world power, then again certain embodiments of it, then anti-Christian, then the Roman world dictatorship in her various forms of existence, for example, imperial, papal, or anti-Christian." Korte Verklaring, page 252.